This is Inspector Toolbelt Talk.
Welcome back to Inspector Toolbelt Talk, everyone. Today we have on a special guest, a repeat guest, Nick Ramico himself. How are you, Nick?
I'm doing well.
So Nick just showed me around his amazing garage with all his cars and carts and wagons and some of the biggest wrenches I've ever seen, and walls of them.
You want big wrenches? Hold on, I'll give you big wrenches. I make up for a wrench where I lack in other areas.
There's some big wrenches. There you go. You got some wrenches that'll take any bolt off.
There's some more maybe here. There's some more for you metric guys.
There you go. Well, today we're having Nick on, not to talk about wrenches, although that would be a great podcast, but we're going to talk about being profitable, building wealth, wealth management, and things that Nick knows about. And Nick, if I could, this is going to sound like a weird question, but I'm just trying to set you up for why you're qualified to talk to us about this kind of stuff. What makes you qualified to talk to us as home inspectors about building wealth, wealth management, profitable businesses, and things like that?
Well, that's a good question. I used to ask this question of myself. I was sort of low self-esteem, and that probably helped me because I always didn't think I was doing well. But after a while, you know, like right now I run 14 companies that I started myself, and all of them are profitable. Some are not very profitable, but they're all profitable. So, I mean, certainly there are better financial guys out there in the world than me, and people have, you know, I'm not Jeff Bezos, but I did okay for a guy who dropped out of high school. So, and I think that because, you know, I didn't learn to read until late, I was born poor, inherited nothing, and dropped out of high school, I probably have a viewpoint on business that may be different than someone else who, you know, who graduated with an MBA, like my wife.
Yeah.
My wife has 4 business degrees and an MBA. So we look at things very differently. And maybe what I can shed some light on is from a different angle than most people, I would say.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I remember we've bonded over the fact that both of us are high school dropouts. I think you made it a half a year longer than I did. I was about halfway through 9th grade. So,
oh, I beat you. I made it to 12th grade.
Oh, you did. Oh, okay. You got me way beat. Yeah.
And then I dropped out. Yeah. I should have dropped out in 10th.
Yeah.
I'd have been 2 years ahead.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Right. So, I do think that you bring something to the table that, so like my brother has a master's degree and he understands business very well. But when he speaks to me about it, it's like we're talking two different languages. I own multiple successful businesses and he owns a successful business, but it's like he's speaking Chinese, I'm speaking Portuguese. It's just two different languages. But I think the language that you speak is more understandable to us as home inspectors because we're down in the nitty gritty and okay, this is what business is from our perspective and not necessarily not that it's good or bad, but from a college education, maybe Jeff Bezos-y kind of Elon Musk view of how things work. A lot more bootstrap, I guess, would be the good expression for it. Bootstrap business mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot of 3-syllable words in my speech. So, you know, I wasn't very good in high school when I was dropping out. So I probably, you're probably talking to someone with an 8th grade education.
And that's okay.
If you can't understand me, maybe you're too smart.
Well, and you do break it down well for us. You put it into the everyman's terms. So that I think I'm going to, I could only guess at how much money you have with 14 successful businesses. You have InterNashi. You helped pioneer the inspection industry. So I think you're very well qualified to tell us on how to become profitable, how to build wealth and wealth management.
Yeah, I mean, my money was made in profitable businesses. You know, I didn't hit the lottery. I didn't win big on Bitcoin or anything. But to this day, you know, it's mostly profitable businesses that are generating everything for me.
Yeah.
You know, that's parabolic in business. If you keep them running, you know, you get more and more each year out of them. So the longer you can keep working, the better.
Yeah.
You know, hope to live long and make a lot of money.
Yeah. So I do want to caveat our conversation here. Sometimes we equate money with success, and that's not always necessarily going to coincide. You said something interesting about a mutual friend that he has all that money and he gets lonely. So we want to make sure that we build success. And when we make our businesses profitable, we kind of keep all of that in perspective. But you said something interesting about home inspectors, the home inspection industry, rather, a week or two ago, maybe longer, that when we were talking one time, that it's very hard to become very profitable as a home inspector without growing your business. In other words, you hit a ceiling.
There's only so much you can make with your own two hands unless mm-hmm. you have some crazy, weird skill like Tiger Woods, right? Tiger Woods can make a lot of money with only his own two hands.
What does he do? He builds walls or something? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, he's a golfer. So what do all rich people have in common who make a lot of money? They have employees. You know, I have 112 employees. Mm. That's about where I should be. I like to be around 100 so I can at least know everybody's name, you know, and a little bit about them. Mm-hmm. If you get, you know, I'm not a person that can run a 1,000 employee company, but regardless of where you are, you know, one employee or 1,000, there's generally some correlation between the number of employees you have and how much you make. You know, you're not going to make, like I said, a lot of money with your own two hands. You might make a good living, but it's difficult to get rich doing that unless you're Tiger Woods or, you know, some musician or something.
Yeah.
You're going to need people.
So I remember you saying that in a previous podcast, and we actually opened this up to inspectors to ask questions, and we got a lot of questions. So some of them are very similar. And that was actually one of the questions, I think Juan de la Cruz, him and a couple of others asked that. I'm at the point of scaling up. In other words, I've grown past where I'm doing things on my own and I want to hire employees and grow a business. Mm-hmm. So his basic question was, how do I go about that? How would you recommend a home inspector scale up?
Well, you probably have to start thinking about delegating when you scale up. And so I wrote a book called Scale Up, believe it or not. You can download it for free.
I have it on my shelf.
Okay. So it's, I think it's at certifiedmasterinspector.org/scale. You can just download it for free. And it gives you like over 100 things you need to do to scale up your business. But mostly you have to be willing to delegate and accept B-plus work. If you're a single operator, you're probably used to doing A-plus work on everything, and you're doing the best you can every day, every hour. You're going to have to forget about doing that anymore. You're going to have to be satisfied with B and B-plus work from your employees. They're never going to be you, and you're going to have to get over that mental hump, I would say, is your biggest problem.
I think that's a beautiful point, because I think that's what prevents most home inspectors from hiring and growing their business. Like, this call center doesn't answer the phone like me. This inspector right. doesn't inspect the roof like you. You're not going to get you. So eventually, not lowering your standards, but accepting acceptable work that's not going to be as perfect as yours. Is the way that I think I look at it. Matter of fact, Mike Ortiz, he asked the question, he's hiring his third guy. So he's able to do that. And he actually mentioned that, you know, accepting that nobody's like you on one of our previous podcasts. And he's heading into his fourth employee this year. He's done really well. He's about 2 years in, 2.5 years in on his fourth employee. He says, what's the best way to move forward and prepare my company for that transition? In other words, going from little owner run to how do I grow bigger? As I go into my fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh employee, like you're at 100 and some odd. How did that work when you started to grow?
So for me, I have ADD, so it worked out really well because I just kept going into other businesses that I found interesting. I would say as you grow, you know, you have to have infrastructure behind it. It's just like a city. A city can't just start slapping up buildings and bringing in people. It has to have bridges to get in and out and road systems and water systems and all that. So he has to give some focus to not just counting how many heads he employs, but what those heads do. So you're going to need someone in the office to start helping. You're going to have managers underneath you. You know, if you take a look at the operations that you're familiar with me, CCPIA, for instance, it's run by Maggie. You know, without her, there's no way I could run that. I don't run it at all. In fact, she runs it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, CMI, IEC2, the insurance companies, the Cozy Codes for Kids, you know, InterNACHI, the House of Horrors, All these things, they operate with someone in charge as well. So if you're getting a 3 and 4, I think you're going to have to put someone in charge. It can't be you and 4 Indians. It's going to have to be you, someone right underneath you, and 3 Indians, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I see a lot of companies when they get to that number of employees, that's what they do. They have like a lead inspector and he runs the inspection team, and then you have an office person and then yourself. I've always said every time you hire an employee in an inspection company, I plan on losing 3/4 of a day per employee. So, you know, checking the reports, working extra to get inspections, managing people. So by the time you get to 5-6 employees, you should really only be doing an inspection once in a while when there's an emergency and just keeping an eye on things, running your business. So that makes a lot of sense.
You got to pick a mini you too. You know, you got to pick somebody who's right underneath you and have them start doing your stuff. Because if you have to manage a bunch of people and still do your stuff, that's not delegating.
Yeah. And it is, it does seem hard to do sometimes. Like maybe it's like we're digging a ditch and we stop to go rent an excavator. Did we lose time to go rent that excavator? Yes. But when we come back with it, it works a lot better. So we may lose time and money hiring a mini me, so to speak, to run the company. But eventually now we can have 6 employees with that guy running them. And we're free to grow the company. That makes a lot of sense.
And also, you know, I think I told you one of the reasons I think I'm financially successful, more wealth than I ever dreamed I'd have, is because I have low self-esteem. So despite my personality at InternetChi, you know, I'm always thinking that I'm probably not right about what I'm thinking about. And so that gave me a big advantage when I hired managers, because when they wanted to do it their way, I didn't say, no, you're going to do it my way. I thought instantly they knew better than me. And that's a big advantage that most businessmen who've been successful on their own don't have. They think that they know the best way to do things. And you're probably wrong about that. Let not only delegate stuff down, but also delegate your authority and keep your mouth shut and see what they do. Even if it looks kind of strange to you, their experiences in life are much different than yours, and they might have a different way of doing it. And it turns out it's a much profitable way, much more profitable way to do things. And that is really hard for most people. And it turned out it's very easy for me, because whenever I see someone attaining our goals from a different angle, the first thing I think of is that I've been doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. Most people think they're doing it wrong. And you can only have this big advantage that I have through low self-esteem. If you believe you're an idiot, you truly believe you're an idiot, like I did for many years, you have an advantage over someone who truly believes they're a genius.
So
that's the original quote, though, by the way. I'm going to put that one in a book.
Yeah. Everybody, business success, wrap up this whole podcast. Think you're an idiot and you'll succeed. But basically, it comes down to, have you ever heard the Dunning-Kruger principle, Nick?
I have not. You know, I don't read books, so I have not.
So I don't read books either, actually. But the Dunning-Kruger effect is these two guys, Dunning and Kruger, did an experiment. They found that nobody actually knows how intelligent they are. So people either way overestimate their skills or way underestimate their skills. And ironically, people that are terrible at something, because they have no benchmark for how terrible they are, think they're awesome. And then people who are actually awesome understand so much about it that they think they're stupid, because how could they actually know what everybody else does about that subject?
Well, it's even worse in my case, because I got rich early. And I got rich a couple of times, right? And so just like everybody else in my neighborhood who thinks I'm smart because I have money, you could actually believe it yourself. You could start to think that I must be smart because I have money. There's some joke about some guy playing the lottery and then he wins. And then he's, you know, he wants to tell everybody out, you know, advice on how to win the lottery and how smart he is. If you know, stick to it and buy a lottery ticket every day, you too can win, you know, and all this nonsense, right? So you have to be careful. You don't become full of yourself as you get rich, because then you're not humble anymore, and you start to think that you know best when certainly you don't. It's very unlikely you know the best way to anything.
Yeah, I think that's actually a deep thought from our discussion. That there is a lot of humility that goes into it. Other people know what we don't know, and the more we can step back and not necessarily have low self-esteem, but be humble and say, maybe they can do it better. Let's see how this plays out. Or maybe just because it's different doesn't mean it's wrong. Interesting. So let's say we are working and we're scaling up. Another question that was added here, are you opposed to debt? And I think a lot of home inspectors are thinking, well, if I want to keep up with this big company, maybe take on some business debt so that I can grow faster. And that, you know, it's like venture capital. A lot of big businesses do that kind of thing. Or do you think it should be more bootstrap?
I prefer it be more bootstrap, but you know, I'm not opposed to debt. That makes a lot of sense in an inflationary environment where there's a lot of inflation. I mean, anybody, you know, we all know this now. We all know Dave Ramsey was wrong, right? We all know people. We all know people with 2.75% mortgages, right, sitting on them when inflation's at, well, they say it's four. It's really like eight.
Yeah,
we're sitting on a real inflation rate of about 8%. So we all know he was wrong, dead wrong, made a mistake. I'm not opposed to debt. It's but there's some satisfaction in, you know, paying for everything, I suppose, without borrowing. Mm-hmm. There might be a spiritual reason also not to borrow. I think the only, you know, I'm not religious, but I know the only time like Jesus kind of got violent with everybody and kicked some butt was with moneylenders. There also might be a psychological reason not to have a lot of other people's cash on hand, because you feel flush when in fact you are not. So it was an advantage to me to always have low self-esteem and always feel like I'm struggling. I always felt until very recently that I was struggling to make it. Mm-hmm. And borrowing money tricks some people into thinking that they're not struggling.
Hmm.
You have to be very wary of your own brain. Your own brain can be a real enemy. And so you don't want to trick it into thinking in a way that could hurt you. And so that would be my opposition to debt for some people. But on paper, absolutely not. Financially, debt makes so much sense in many situations. So before we get into too much on whether someone should borrow to grow their and expand their home inspection business, you know, you have to start thinking about that first. You know, you also don't want to borrow money for no reason, just to grow big. You know, size doesn't matter. Bottom line does in business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless you're, again, trying to raise money, which is a form of borrowing, a form of debt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about how big you are. Worry about how profitable you are. I have some very small businesses that have no employees that are outrageously profitable. We see that the human brain wants to be big. When we see this when they design their own brochures and their own websites. You go to a lot of home inspection companies where their wife and the husband design their own website and design their own brochure. The name of their company is taking up all the precious real estate. They're revealing the problem with their own brain, that they want their name so big on the above the fold of the website, their company name. They want it real big on their inspection vehicle, even though it doesn't say home inspection on it. So you don't even know what the darn company does unless you have glasses to see, you know, underneath the word home inspection. So they, you know, they trade all their precious real estate for ego, to satisfy their ego of being big. Instead, they should be using that precious real estate to sell their services and explain to people what they do and why people should hire them. that's a perfect, and I see that so many times that it reveals to me that most people, or most home inspectors certainly, you know, focus on being big instead of profitable.
You know, that's another deep thing that you just said there. I remember this one home inspector was bragging about how many inspections he did in a year and how many employees he had.
You stand on stage sometime and do it.
Yeah. Well, my question to him was, share your net profit.
Yeah.
He shared his gross numbers. I'm like, how much of that is net?
Right.
And not that he was going to do it in a public forum, but I knew him personally. He goes, Ian, it's not going so well. I didn't want to share that number. I'm like, then why are you bragging about all the number of inspections? And if you're not,
exactly,
you could have a third of the size of the company be more profitable.
If you ever go to one of these events where there's stools, they're not chairs, they're stools, they're about 3 foot tall. And there's guys sitting on stools, five of them in a row on a stage, and they're telling you how much they grossed. This is usually a bunch of crap. You know, I want to see the profit margins. And I want to see your bottom line. Let me see your bank accounts. Don't show them. Tell me how many inspections you did. Because if you did a bunch of inspections, you know, a lot, enough to be on stage bragging about it, and people like this, right? And people in the audience sit next to their wives with pen and paper. If you're in one of those situations, and you haven't made any money, you're not really making any big money. You've harmed our industry. You're my enemy. Because all you did was churn and suck inspections out of the system through the skills you had to acquire inspections, but not to acquire profit. You're the biggest enemy in my industry. I would love to just crush you out because you're stealing jobs and wasting them. For someone to do thousands of inspections and not end up rich, that person didn't go out into an enormous cornfield and pick enough corn for himself and his family. He burnt large swaths of the cornfield down so that nobody can eat. He took those jobs and wasted them, stole them from other inspectors who could have made a profit out of them, and did it thousands and thousands of times over and over for years. And at the end had nothing to show for it. And all he did was harm us all. That's my biggest enemy in this industry. It's within. It's not without. It's not NAR.
Yeah.
It's that idiot sitting on that bench on stage telling us how many inspections he did without showing me his house. Show me your paid off house and then we'll talk. I want to see that first. Let me look at your house. Let me see that it's how much you owe on it. Then go up on stage and tell us how you did it. Otherwise, I suspect a lot of these guys are just stealing work from everybody. When you do a job and you don't make any money off of it, you're a thief. You're a thief to my industry.
Unfortunately, I think most of our listeners would agree that it's not just one or a group of five guys doing 10,000 inspections each. It's a lot of us that are single inspectors or, you know, smaller companies not making a profit. I talk with guys all the time and they're like, oh, I have to compete at 350. So, and then they wonder why they can't make their bills, but they did 600 and 700 inspections by themselves.
They worked their ass off.
Yeah. They worked for nothing. I did the math with this one guy at the end of the year of how many hours he spent attaining the inspections, getting ready for the inspections, driving to them, doing them. He was doing three a day. He ended up making just above minimum wage at the end of the year. He's working, you know, 100 hours a week, 7 days a week. He didn't even have a vacation that year, he said. And I'm like, go to McDonald's. I'm like, go. That's a lot easier job for minimum wage.
Less stress, less liability. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think what you're saying is very true because we get in our own way. So, but let's say now that we're one of the inspectors where we do well and we make profit. One of the things that I struggle with is I've always been very good at making money. And then it sits on my desk, proverbially speaking, as a paperweight. I'm like, oh, hey, look. And then I move on to the next thing that interests me and I want to go do this. What does a home inspector do with money after he has it? What would you tell him to do?
So, you know, I think of things in terms of battles, right? So one of the enemies in finance is cash because of the United States has so much debt. That debt has to be serviced. I think they're running up a debt of what, $1 trillion every 100 days or something. No one's buying our notes, so they have to print this money. All this printing of money, and it's worldwide. Every currency is doing it right around the world.
It's fiat currency.
Fiat,
yeah,
currency is going to zero as it always does. It's just going globally. It's all going to zero. So with inflation, you know, you have to, if your profit margin is 15% and there's 8% inflation, you're only making 7% because you're fighting upstream against inflation. So without, you know, getting into too deep, you know, into it. And I wrote an article on it. It's at natchi.org/wealth, how inspectors can store wealth. But basically you have to buy things that you can touch in general. Mm-hmm. If you can't touch it, you know, it's not there really. And so I think there's a whole list of things you can buy. And some is with just $100, you know, like maybe you should go buy groceries now and store them because they're going up. You know, groceries went up 40% in 4 years. Mm-hmm. And it goes all the way up to, you know, something where you can spend a lot of money to try to hedge inflation. But you have to get rid of your cash. I'm sitting on some cash and I would love to deploy it and I can't find opportunity. I mean, the real estate market is high where I'm at. The stock market is, you know, all-time high. PEs or ratios are crazy, right? Gold broke, you know, 4 or 5 all-time highs in a row in the past two mm-hmm. weeks. So I don't know where to deploy cash really. And I don't think I'm alone. I think probably other people with cash have the same problem. And that's why the market is as high as it is and things are as high as they are. I mean, we're having a commodity bubble right now. I mean, planet Earth has two things that it's sort of swimming in. It's swimming in oil. Mm-hmm. More oil now than when they told me in third grade that we're reaching peak oil. From now on, we're going to never find any more. So we have more oil reserves now than ever before. It's a planet of oil and it's a planet of cash. We're swimming in it. There's cash all over the place and no place to go. And I'm not sure what to do about that completely, but you have to get into a variety of things that you can touch. I would say, you know, right now, if someone had forced me to deploy money, I would say I would buy mining stocks, I think. Miners at least pull something real out of the ground that's going to be needed, you know, whether it's lithium or copper or silver right now. Or gold, those stocks are basically selling for the same thing they sold 5 years ago. It's the only thing that didn't go up. It's the only commodity, precious metals are the only commodities that didn't go up. They just started to go up recently, and the mining stocks behind them haven't really budged much. They got a long way to go. So if you're asking me today, I would say go buy some Newmont, Barrick, or some, if you want to get into a junior mining stock and try to, you know, get a 10 banger out of it, if you want to take a little risk, do that. Those are very undervalued. And silver is still very undervalued. You know, it's not even close to its all-time high of $50 or something. It's only coming up on 30, right? Despite every other commodity going through the roof.
You know, it's ironic. You're the second person to tell me that recently, mining stocks. I might have to listen to that and go get some. But I do find that question comes up a lot with business owners in general, not just us as home inspectors, of where to put our money. And we're always told things like, you know, do mutual funds, like a lot of people do, like places like Betterment and all that stuff, or high yield savings accounts. You should have at least 6 months, they say, or a year of your life expenses in like a high yield savings account, like Goldman Sachs or something like that.
But I mean, you can get pretty good interest rates now. You can get 4.8% just by walking into a bank. So
yeah,
you know, it's not
but that's just keeping up with inflation, really.
We're
just
losing barely a little bit to it.
Yeah, losing.
We haven't made any money. But you have to ask yourself other questions. You have to ask, am I going to need cash in the future or in the near future? Mm-hmm. The answer is no, then you got a problem because you got to figure out what to do with this money, right?
Yeah. So you've always been a proponent of gold, but like physical gold, like the old Ron Swanson adage of burying gold in a box in the backyard next to the oak tree where nobody can find it.
Well, I mean, you just said why. You just explained one of my reasons I like gold is because, you know, someone once said, well, can't the government find your gold? I said, I don't think so because I can't find some of it. I'm 62. I forgot where I put it. But you know, it's the only financial instrument that has no third party counter risk to it. There's nobody can take it away from me. Nobody can lose it. You know, you mentioned other things like 401ks and stuff like that. I'm not interested in that. I You know, I have money in the stock market, but I don't want too much of it in there. I'm a trader. I'm only trading in and out, you know, constantly. You see me on InternetU's message board, I announce some things I buy, and then you see me dump it like in 2 days. As soon as it goes up, I dump. So, yeah. You know, I'm a trader in and out, but, you know, because that's not wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, wealth is something that you should be able to touch, I think. And, you know, maybe real estate's for you if you're less worried about the government. I mean, the government knows where your real estate is, and they know you can't move it. So it's kind of on the front line. If you're sort of a, you know, anti-government conspiracy theorist like me, you know, I have a lot of real estate. I have 55 properties. So I'm not against real estate. And, but it's the stuff that's most out front, right? You can't pull it away on wheels. You can't hide it. And they can tax the crap out of it, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And probably on the other side of that, in between, and it's everything in between, would be gold. So it's small. It's indestructible. If your house catches on fire and it melts into gold. I mean, it's a monetary instrument. It's used in everything. Silver is really going to be the big one. Silver and copper, I think. You know, if they really get this, you know, electrification of the world going, you're going to need a lot of silver.
Yeah. Well, Europe is already mostly there. UK, a lot of them are already there for the electrification. So, okay. So I do like the physical asset thing. I have a hard time with real estate sometimes just because of the tax thing. I live in New York and we're highly taxed.
Oh, yeah.
So, and really, when it comes down to it, with few exceptions, like over the past few years, real estate as a whole just keeps up with inflation. So if you buy a house,
it pays rent.
Well, if you're renting, yeah.
Well, it does three things at once, right? So real estate is a special kind of thing because it does three things at once. First of all, it pays a dividend every month. I mean, you know, last week was the end of the month for me, so I got a stack of checks, right? I mean, all the rentals pay income. And that rent goes up with inflation, just like anything else, right? So it's a hedge against inflation, right? It's a tax deduction because you can say like Donald Trump does, right? You can say that your real estate is going down in value on paper, despite it going up in value in reality. That whoever wrote that, I don't know about legislative history, but whoever came up with that idea, I mean, to be able to say that this property is going down in value while in fact it's going up in value. That's a big tax saving. So that's number two, right? Dividend. You get a dividend every month. You get a tax write off. And then the third thing, the thing itself appreciates. So it's a double hedge against inflation, right? Because the rents are going up, but then the thing is going up with inflation. So, I mean, there's a reason most people who got really rich on their own did it with real estate. And it's because of those three things. Hmm. You combine those three things, there's nothing that touches it. Gold doesn't pay a dividend, right?
Yeah.
And I can't depreciate gold. So it only has one of the three things. Some things have two of the three things. This has all three. Real estate is amazing. So I have a lot of it. So
yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point. And I'm not exactly a real estate guru. I just never had a stomach for renting properties, but it is a little bit hard right now because real estate's so high. I mean, a house down the street from me sold double what it was purchased for just 5 years ago. I'm like, what in the world? Double.
Yeah. I mean, so 4 years ago, the average, you needed an average seller of like $59,000 to buy the average house in America. Mm-hmm. And today you need an average seller of $103,000.
Exactly.
So it really went past inflation, didn't it?
It flew. Well, and there's a housing shortage. Whenever that's economics 101. You don't have enough of something, so it becomes more valuable. So,
and I think that's the government's secret weapon. What they're really doing, right? They have this big debt, and there's only three ways of getting rid of this big debt. We can pay it. Well, we can't. I mean, if you took all the tax receipts that came in, tax receipts dropped 5% this year, by the way, already. So, you know, compared to last year. So if we gave them all the money we earned, we can barely service this darn thing. It's growing so big, right? So we can't pay the debt. The second way is to default on it. Just tell the Chinese, too bad, you know, and everybody else, Social Security recipients, sorry. You know, we just can't tell the military, you just can't attack the wrong countries anymore. You know, when the Saudis hit us on 9/11, you can't go attack Afghanistan and Iraq. and spend 20 years over there. Can't do it. It costs us $9 trillion to do that. No more doing that anymore. You're going to have to call Nick Romico, and he'll send you a 95-cent map of the Middle East so you can actually go retaliate for 911 the way you should have with surgical strikes and got out. You can't spend $9 trillion over dollars. That's defaulting, right? Tell them, okay, no, you're cut off. Social Security recipients, you're cut off. Medicaid, Medicare, the Chinese, everybody has our notes. You're all done. We're defaulting. We've defaulted before, so it's not a big deal. But they're not going to do that. There's no way. No politician's going to do that. So the only third way to get rid of all this debt, and the one they're doing, is to inflate it away. Basically add zeros to everything. And then the debt becomes worth the debt becomes only one-tenth of its size. For, it's just a basic math if you did that, right? So how do you cause inflation? Well, one is to print a lot of money, which they're doing, right? You know, they're never going to – they act like they're trying to get to 2%. They're never going to get to 2%. They have no intention to. They want inflation. And what's the other way to cause inflation? Increase demand. So let millions of illegal immigrants in. Everyone as immigrants has to eat and needs a roof over their head. You put that pressure on it, inflation goes up. They want, despite everything they say, whenever the government's saying something over and over, and you got the chairman of the Federal Reserve on 60 Minutes, what's he doing on there? A TV show, you know, a couple of times a month. You know, we shouldn't even know his name. He should be insignificant to us. But whenever they're on there saying they're trying to get rid of inflation, it's because they're trying to create it. And they have a clear motive to. They ran up the debt. They have to inflate it away. Inflation's a tax on everybody. And it's a sneaky tax because everybody votes for it, not knowing that they're paying it. It's like corporate tax. You know, everybody say, oh, we got to get these corporations to pay more tax. No, that's a tax on you. Corporations, I have a lot of them. I have a lot of corporations. They're just three pieces. I have to show you them. They're just three pieces of paper in a file cabinet. They can't pay tax. Corporation can't pay tax. It can only collect in the form of higher prices and pass it on to bureaucrats. It's a sneaky way of taxing you. It's just the same way as when I hire an employee and he says, well, a lot of taxes came out of my paycheck. Well, you should see what I had to pay to hire you. It's a sneaky, that money could have been yours. It's a sneaky way of taxing you. Corporations don't pay tax. People pay tax. So if you raise a corporate tax, you're taxing us in a form of higher prices. If you vote for certain people, you're taxing yourself with higher inflation because it allows the government to print money. And do they give it to you? No, they spend it on themselves and you pay it in a form of groceries.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complex parts to that issue, but inflation is definitely something that affects our decisions of what we do with what money we have. And to go back to the debt thing, I do tend to think that some debt is good. Like, I think if you're going to buy a house, even with a higher interest rate, buy it and refinance when the interest rates go down, because then you end up paying back, if you buy something for $500,000, in 10 years, that money's worth less. So now you're paying back money that's worth less to pay off that debt. So that dollar is now worth 80 cents. So
debt is a hedge against inflation.
Yeah.
So again, as inflation goes up, Dave Ramsey gets more and more wrong. Debt is who benefits inflation. In fact, inflation is basically a transfer of wealth from savers to borrowers.
Yeah.
Think of it that way.
Pretty much.
So if you're saving money, you're losing it. You're not losing the money nominal. You're losing it in purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
And the borrower is paying back the debt that he got a lot of purchasing power to buy a house, and he's paying it back with dollars that are more and more worthless.
Yep.
So he's the winner, the saver's the loser. It's a transfer of wealth. Inflation's a transfer of wealth from savers to borrowers.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Yeah. If I could, to get back down maybe to a couple of the questions, I know you didn't want to talk about the NAR thing, and we don't have to talk about that, but it does bring up a question from one of our inspectors here who wanted to know, basically, if it's not that, what's the biggest threat to home inspectors, to the industry? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you mentioned a big one is inflation. You know, if you go to the, you know, Inspector Museum in Boulder, Colorado, which, you know, we started, in there are inspection reports. And some of those reports have the invoices from when they did them in the 70s and the 80s, right? Those invoices don't look terribly different than today's invoices. That's crazy. You know, we haven't really given ourselves a raise. And we're doing a much better job. I mean, we do photographs inside, color photographs inside our reports. You know, we do all sort of ancillary inspections. We do, you know, we email the reports. We have insurance. We have the buyback program. We have warranties, all to protect our clients. You know, we have all a variety of tools that we never had back then, infrared cameras and moisture meters. We're a much better industry than we were in 1980, providing a much better service than we were in 1980. Mm-hmm. Yet our prices, which should be six times what it was in 1980, are 1.5 times.
If that.
Yeah. So you asked me, what is your threat to the inspection industry? We already talked about it. Inflation.
What do you think about the commoditization of the industry? Because I think there's a little bit more of that than there used to be.
Do you mean like big multi-inspector firms?
Not necessarily. It's more of a mentality of like, you know, you used to years ago look for a home inspector. And I remember having to compete really hard on skill levels, where now it's the mentality of buyers of you just need to get through the inspection, kind of like you do with appraisers. You don't meet your appraiser. You don't ask him about a skill level. You don't ask to see sample reports. You just get whoever met the price line. They go do the appraisal and you move on. Do you see the same thing happening to the home inspection industry?
Yeah. But I always look at that and, you know, cause I'm looking at it through other industries. I'm in a variety of other industries that have nothing to do with home inspections. And I always look at that as an advantage. So I'm hoping the industry around me commoditizes in that sense.
Really? Okay.
Becomes homogenized and similar and lower in price and sort of just grumbles along without getting any real power or distinctiveness, because that's what I'm going to get. I'm happy to be the odd man out. And I'm even odder the more you guys all become the same. So I'm going to stand out from you. My CEO is a pretty smart kid. He always says, we wish we had 10 Ashies that are all bumbling around doing nothing like the regular Ashy, because we would stick out really well in an Ashy. Don't put them out of business. He was always begging me, please don't put them out of business. We need 10 more. So if you adopted his thinking to inspectors, it doesn't really harm you that there's a bunch of bozos out there doing the same thing over and over, looking similar, because this just enhances, and I'm a marketing guy, so maybe, you know, I'm not talking to everybody. Everybody says, well, it's easy for you. I'm a marketing guy. I'll do a little bit more better marketing than them, and I'll take the gravy. And you can have all the rest. You can have all the potatoes that you want. I can't do it all anyway. So I prefer the 90% that I can't do to be done by those who are similar and weak. So it keeps them at bay. That's a way of looking at it.
I actually really like that perspective, Nick, because I was wondering where you were going with that. And that makes a lot of sense. So if everybody else is McDonald's, and you're the gourmet burger shop,
I'm happy.
Yeah. So that's actually because just yesterday, the guy was just like, oh, this industry is going down. Everything is commoditizing. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. But no, that's a great perspective of it gives us opportunity to stand out as different.
It's a great opportunity for single man operators. So I wrote an article, natchi.org/get-rich. And I list four ways that home inspectors can get rich. And one of them is the single man operator just kills it. He's just becomes so amazing. You know, he's Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ways to do it, you know. And I'm sure Tiger Woods would think the same. He would love to play against his whole career against a pile of mediocre golfers that never took a dollar from any of the money that he was going after. He'd win all the tournaments and have all the endorsements, and nobody else could compete. Well, in business, that would be a dream, And so the closer they become to, they come to doing that, the sweeter my dream.
Which makes a lot of sense because actually Peter Ganino, sorry, Peter, if I pronounced your name wrong, but he asked, how does a home inspector survive in an area where there are two or three multi-inspector firms getting all the work? And I guess that's the answer to the question. It's not a matter of how do I compete with them? It's perfect. The more they homogenize and kind of do everything the same, what can I do to be even better than that and come out as Tiger Woods?
You have to start with everything, right? You have to clean up your whole marketing and everything to attack, to pull away from that, right? I mean, maybe if you're just you and your wife and your son doing the inspections, you could say, you know, not a franchise, family owned and operated. I mean, that tagline would cause a consumer to say, well, I don't want these franchises. I want the family owned and operated guy, right? If you're just a single man, right? And you're just a single woman just doing out there competing with multi-inspector firms and franchises, maybe your tagline would be, you know, picture of yourself, you know, saying you actually get me at the inspection, sending one of my underling employees, something like that, right?
That's cold.
People want to know who's coming to the house. Who are they actually hiring? Anyway, when the world all gets the same, it becomes easier and easier from your marketing to distinguish. And marketing is basically a tool to distinguish yourself from others, right? That's what it is. So you can, that accelerates the more they become homogenized. So I look at it as a good thing. I mean, now if you're just a home, I just want to do my little inspections and get in there and make a couple of money. Then maybe you should jump in with the rest of them then. You know, but that would not be anything I would do. Your software is not that, is it? Are you trying to be Home Inspector Pro and Home Gauge and everybody else and ISN and everything?
No, matter of fact, we get flack sometimes because we're different. We want to be different. We want to stand out. Yeah.
Well, they say, you know, if you're not getting flack, you know.
Yep. You're going to get flack when you're doing something right.
You're not over the target. You know, flack is what hits the plane. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's okay to be different, you know.
Yeah. And I do like that. And even with our software.
I have no reason to have pricing that is all my pricing and every one of my businesses are considered high. I can't argue that I should charge you more if there's nothing behind my argument. It would be like an attorney going into a trial and say, Your Honor, I move to that you boo blah blah this, and then he sits down. The judge would be like, well, you know, are you supporting your contention in any way before I rule against you? So you want to have reasons to charge more. I know. I mean, this is the game. I mean, we're in here to make money, and I'm tired of these inspectors saying, "Well, I make a good living." Well, then go get a good job. The only reason to be in business and take on all this risk and do all the things home inspectors have to do is to make a really, really great living. If you're just putting along and, you know, and putting food on the table, oh my God, please get out of my industry. Go away. Get a job. Well, I don't need an inspector who puts food on his table. If that's his goal, I wish he would go away.
I mean, there is a lot to say about that, a lot to unbox, because there's a lot that goes into a business that we don't think about. The late nights, the worry, the work, the advertising, the marketing. We think, boy, I made $500 in 2 hours. No, you didn't. It took you 8 hours to get to that 2 hours.
Why do all that for nothing?
Yeah.
You'd be better off working.
Yep, exactly. But that's why we have you on the show, is because you're going to say the real stuff that we need to hear. I think we got through the bulk. We had a lot of people submit questions, and I'm trying to combine some of them. But is there anything that you'd like to add for inspectors, Nick, either about...
I mean, what was the theme of this interview?
Basically, the theme is how to gain wealth and profit as a home inspector. And I think that's kind of what we're targeting here.
If we're wrapping up, we didn't get into any details. We should probably do a detailed one. But, you know, generally, there's a three-part system to getting rich, which is to increase your income, which usually means increasing your sources of income, managing your expenses. You don't want to buy boats and yachts. I mean, you can have an occasional luxury in life, but you don't want it all. You don't want a big house. I wanted a big house. That was my luxury, but I don't have a yacht or boats or anything like that. You can have an occasional luxury. I'm not saying don't enjoy life, but you don't want a lot of them. You don't want to keep spending to keep up with your income. So increase your income, manage your expenses, and invest the rest. I mean, it's kind of like a simple three-part system. A lot of people do two or three. You know, a lot of older people did the first two, actually.
Mm-hmm. Fiscal discipline is extremely important. I do, you know, not to quote Dave Ramsey too much, because I know how your feelings on him, but he talked about, he's like, if you make $100,000 a year and you buy an $80,000 car, he says you're stupid. He goes, if you're making $300,000 a year and you own a boat, two $80,000 cars and a big house, you're stupid. He says some of the same things that you're saying of fiscal discipline.
It's the same thing we talked about earlier about the guy on stage, right? We want to look at his margin, right? So in personal finance, your margin is your income versus your expenses. Mm-hmm. So we want to see that. We want to see a healthy margin there. In the same way, we want to see that guy on stage talking about how many home inspections he did last year. We want to see his margins is what we really want to see. Same thing with personal finance. We want to see a margin. And then what does he do with it? Don't keep it in cash, as we discussed on the show earlier, too. Not in this environment. You want to put it somewhere where it grows and it helps with the first step, which is income. You know, I like dividend stocks. I love, you know, rents, things that spin off a little bit.
Yeah, and I do like the fact that you went back to that point, because, again, it is one of my biggest pet peeves when inspectors tell me how many inspections they do. You don't need to tell me how much money you make, but don't brag about, oh, me and my helper, we did 1,000 inspections this year. I'm like, big stinking whoop. How much did you make at the end of the year? What was your profit margin? Because I know guys out there that charge a premium, do a couple hundred inspections a year, and make more than some multi-inspector firms.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, look at me. My gross revenues are not that much in all my companies, but I know how to get that margin. Or I don't do it. If I can't figure it out, I don't do it. You know, so you should focus on that.
So I will say, getting into some of the detail, let me know if you agree or disagree with this. If I were starting out in business today, and let's say I was doing 50 inspections a year, just starting out.
How many?
50. Just guessing. You know, if I was just starting out, I was doing 50. Personally, I would invest in commercial inspections because it's bigger money and it's basically the same job. And I think it's a lot better. And then you can get reciprocal income. And then we've talked about this a lot on the show. You can do yearly inspections, maintenance inspections, and a lot of those commercial inspections turn into regular income. Home inspections tend to be a dead stop. And home inspections, we shouldn't stop doing it, but I think we should have a couple avenues of money. I think we should grow bootstrap personally. I've never taken on any debt for any business. It's not my thing.
Me either.
And it doesn't, yeah. So take it from people that have built businesses. Yes, debt has its place with parts of life, but when it comes to business, it does change your brain. It really does. When you're doing things bootstrap, there's a different mentality in that business, and it tends to grow organically. But would you agree with those couple of statements I said, or would you disagree?
I do. I think it goes back to one of the three things I said. You have to get your income up. I would have a second stream of income, which is a commercial inspection company, completely separate from my home inspection company.
Always. Yep.
Completely separate websites, separate entities, separate altogether.
Yep.
And you'll find that management business, because it's not a home inspection business at all. It's not an inspection business at all. You don't need knee pads. You don't have to go crawling around anywhere. You're going to hire everybody almost the way I do them. You know, I'm a commercial inspector. You want to manage it out, especially as you're getting older. Like, I'm 62. I don't know how old you are, but at your age and up, you want to start going towards commercial, because you need a management business late in life. Home inspections is a physical business. Mm-hmm. You got to be in great shape for it, and it'll beat you up over time. Whereas the commercial inspections, it's all a management business. It's a scalable business, and it's a beautiful desk business, which I like. I always say, if you can try to build your commercial inspection business as if you were blinded, and you know, accidentally blinded. So, or just put a blindfold on. And if you can run it from your desk with just your phone, you're doing, you know, and unable to see very far. Maybe you can just see enough to type your invoice. You're doing right. I don't even retype the reports from the experts I hire for each project anymore. I used to. I used to put it all. I thought consistency mattered in a report. I just now staple their report to mine, to my cover letters, and what I did on the inspection. And I haven't had a single commercial client complain about it. In fact, they like it. It appears even better because it looks like different people with different expertise worked on their inspection, which in fact is what actually happened. So I can charge a lot more. Why would I want to homogenize it and make it like I'll retype it all into one report? I'm not in a report writing contest. I'm in a money making business.
Yeah. And then it's recurring income, which is important for any business. So
it's B2B. I like.
Yeah. B2B is good. Yep. That's extremely important. A lot less drama. I also find that other ancillary businesses help. A lot of very successful home inspection companies start pest control companies. And again, that's recurring income. You're out at that house once every 6 months, every year, and you can run that from your desk. You have the inspection, you finish it, send it off to your pest company, and you move on to the next inspection. Water treatment, almost part of almost no SOP in most states in the U.S. So water treatment systems, radon installation companies, I was talking with a home inspector yesterday, started an environmental company, and he doesn't cross over with his home inspections and that, but you know what? Somebody needs a radon mitigation system, guess who they call?
One of the Ukrainian refugees that I took into my house to get them out of the war and out onto the street, started his own filter business. But you can't imagine how many filters there are in a house. I mean, between your water filters and your furnace filters and everything. He goes around and changes all the filters. He has actually most of them on his truck, the rest of them in his warehouse. And it's a heck of a service. It's repeat business. You know, he only needs like 150 clients to get he doesn't have that quite yet, but to get really, really wealthy the way he's doing it. Because they just give him repeat business. He comes back every few months and changes all the filters, and he knows what filters they have. Like, do you really know when you get ice out of your freezer, you know, do you know what size filter that is or even where it is?
I do, but I'm weird.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Most people.
Furnace filter sizes or the last time they changed it. Right. So it's a really great, business. It's attractive to people who are more affluent.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's why I guess I'm pointing out too, it's not overcomplicated things, but we have access to the client first and we can build off of that. Right. So like the water treatment company, I remember water treatment company charged me $90 to come tap their finger on the top of the timer and say, oh yeah, that's still working. Dump two bags of salt in and they were gone in 5 minutes. I'm like, that's a glorious business.
Glorious.
Glorious. I mean, the initial setup and everything, you might need your best guy to go do that. But then after that, have your 18-year-old nephew just starting out working in the summers, dropping salt into people's water softeners for $90 a pop all summer. I gladly pay because I'm like, listen, I'm not going to go drive to Home Depot, get 20 bags of salt, drive back, dump all this salt in, spend 3 hours doing it. I'm like, it's worth it to me to just have somebody do it, you know? So anytime we can do that, I always find multiple streams of recurring income is always going to be the best. And that's an unfortunate part of home inspections. No recurring income. People have tried it.
Steady clients is a great, any business that has regular clients is a great business.
Yeah.
You know, you can sell them, you can upsell them a lot of stuff. They trust you over time. You trust them over time.
Mm-hmm. You have a relationship.
I don't want the crazy clients. So I want my good clients. And a book of business is why insurance companies get rich. It's not because they sell insurance. It's because they resell insurance.
Well, have you ever watched The Office, Nick? There was that one episode where...
I don't have a TV. I have a TV. I don't watch it.
All right. I love TV. It's kind of like TV raised me. So, but there's this one episode where this guy's in business school and he asked the question on the show, is it more profitable to keep an existing client or to get a new one? And he was just quizzing them. And the answer was, it's always better to keep an existing client than acquire a new one. Home inspections, we have a great business. It really is like the coolest life ever, driving around,
right,
seeing cool things, meeting cool people, but we have high acquisition costs.
Yeah.
And then we never see that client again until they sell their house in 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, or worse, we acquire an agent who gives us work, but because there's 2 million of them chasing 5.1 million deals, you know, the average real estate agent can only give us two or three a year.
Well, and a lot of them are going out of business. Some are freaking out about the NAR thing going out of business. So now what if 10 of our 20 agents that refer us go out of business? We lost half our work.
I'll say this. They never had a business.
Well, yeah, exactly.
When your average real estate agent makes $30,000 a year gross before expenses and taxes.
Yeah.
It was never a business.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of these things where they're just sucking money out of the system and not making any profit with it. Now, there's a few exceptions, of course. In any industry, there are a few exceptions and there are realtors that do really well for themselves. But the great vast majority of them don't feed themselves on that.
Yep.
You know, they're probably married to a spouse who's really carrying the load if they really broke it down and looked at where the money's coming in, coming out. You know, looked at the wear and tear on their car, their marketing costs, and everything to go get those three deals done a year on average. Oh my God, they never had a business. We at least have a business that we don't charge enough for.
Yeah.
They don't even have a business. They're not even doing enough volume. You can't. There's only 5 million deals.
Out of a real estate transaction, I would say the home inspector makes the most money on average per hour. Because, you know, the attorney works, attorneys in my area charge $500 to $1,000, but they're working lots of hours, employees and stuff like that. Agents not making much money. The appraiser's not making much money.
Yep. And the agent definitely makes the least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. After their office fees and splitting the commission eight ways.
It may look like the biggest check, but it's actually a really bad business. You know what I mean?
No, I agree. So if you're a home inspector listening to this, you made the right choice. And to sum up Nick's expression earlier, we need to think we're all idiots and we'll all succeed. I'm just kidding. But
it worked for me, and my thought process may have been accurate. Who knows?
No, you've done really well, Nick. And Nick, as always, great podcast. And I know we could go on forever talking about this, but I think this gives home inspectors a good idea of where to go from here, so to speak, of how to start maybe tweaking our thinking is really what it comes down to, is what I'm gathering from you. Not necessarily what we do mechanically. Okay, if I do X, Y, Z, this will work. A lot of it comes down to our thinking.
We should get into the mechanics on another podcast.
Let's do it. I'm down with that.
As you can see,
yeah,
get the wrenches out.
Yeah, we'll get the wrenches out and get on the nuts and bolts.
That's what I'd rather do.
Okay, let's do it. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks.
On behalf of myself, Ian, and the entire ITB team, thank you for listening to this episode. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you can catch our future episodes as well. And if you have any feedback, please send us an email at info@inspectortoolbelt.com. Also, don't forget to check out our brand new app for home inspectors, scheduling and report writing all in one easy-to-use app. Check it out now at inspectortoolbelt.com.
The views and opinions of this podcast and its guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Inspector Toolbelt and its associates.